By a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Is a wooden cutting board as good or better than plastic? Are antibacterial soaps a good idea? How concerned need we be about avian flu? On the program today, we'll talk about identifying disease and preventing it. We'll also explore our current capabilities in disease prediction and surveillance. Our guest is Dr. Alan Zelikoff, co-author with Michael Bellamo of Microbe, Are We Ready for the Next Plague? In the foreword to the book, the authors note, prevention is always less costly than treatment, and early identification of disease in a population gives us the luxury of using prevention for the many. They emphasize early response, saying that progress has been made, but there's more to be done. How important is early identification? Here's an example from the book. If public health authorities had had the jump on West Nile when it hit New York in 1999, they might have had a chance at snuffing out a disease that is, in the words of Zelikoff and Bellamo, now here to stay in North America. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with a phone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Outside the local dialing area, call toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Dr. Alan Zelikoff is a physician and physicist, a former senior scientist at Sandia National Laboratory's International Programs and Non-Proliferation Department. He is currently senior scientist at Ares Corporation, and he is the inventor of the Syndrome Reporting Information System for the Rapid Dissemination of Disease Information. The book, Microbe, Are We Ready for the Next Plague, is published by Amacom. 333-9455, that's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, you can call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Zelikoff, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Great pleasure to be here, Celeste. Thank you.
Sure. Summer 1999, crows and some other birds were dying in New York City. As you point out, crows are birds that don't have a role in agriculture or industry and are not kept for economic reasons. So how was it that the alarm bells began to ring?
It was due to the astute observation of one veterinary pathologist, in my book, one of the greatest heroes of infectious disease in the modern era, Tracy McNamara of the Bronx Zoo, who literally noticed two things. One, birds were falling out of the sky, and they tended to be of the corvid variety, which are large birds like magpies and crows. And because she worked at the Bronx Zoo, she was able to look out her window and see that very few of the exotic birds, if any, that were in the zoo were ill. So she came rapidly to the conclusion that we were dealing with a new virus or new infectious disease agent that affected New World birds but not Old World birds. And then when she picked up one of the crows and took it to her lab and saw that the brain was inflamed, she knew that the bird had some form of what's called encephalitis. That's not a diagnosis but sort of a category of disease or a syndrome. And she was able to rapidly narrow those possibilities down because none of her exotic birds in the zoo were ill. So she knew she had something new on that on the line, literally within hours of doing her first autopsy, which was literally just a few hours after she picked up one of the dead birds.
Yeah, well,
unfortunately, no one listened.
Right, for her it was a few hours, but it really wasn't. It was days, weeks, months.
That's correct, and that's the main lesson of the West Nile outbreak, which is that hours matter. Days are simply too late. Even Senator Frist has written a book about this. I think he calls it Every Moment Counts, and he's exactly right. And that's where our public health system is exquisitely designed to fail. It doesn't respond in hours. It doesn't even respond in days. It sometimes responds in weeks, but if you look at some of the other strange outbreaks we've had in the United States, like, for heaven's sakes, the monkeypox outbreak not far from you, I think it was Wisconsin or Minnesota, it took a month. I wish I were making this up. I'm not. But it took a month from the time of the first case until the official alarm went out from the Wisconsin Department of Health indicating that monkeypox was circulating among pet prairie dogs and would be a risk to humans.
Hmm.
Now, if that had been smallpox instead of monkeypox, monkeypox is not very well adapted to humans, but if it had been smallpox instead of monkeypox, I would say we'd be having a very different conversation today if we'd be having one at all. That is clearly an inadequate response, but it characterizes, I'm afraid, all of the novel disease outbreaks we've seen in the past three or four decades in the United States.
Oh. Novel diseases. You know, there's a saying, when you see hoof prints, suspect horses, not
right.
Zebras.
Right.
Is that part of the problem?
It is. When I was in medical school, that was, of course, the famous mantra uttered by just about every clinician. It was sort of the thoughtless rote mantra that unfortunately characterizes a lot of medicine. When birds fall out of the sky, or when humans have funny lesions on their hands, those aren't hoof prints or paw prints that are representative of usual infectious disease.
Hmm. When and how was the link made between the deaths of the birds and what had made some people in Queens sick?
Right. It depends who you ask. In sort of the kindest treatment of, or the most optimistic answer to your question, it was a couple of weeks. At the time that the birds were dying, shortly thereafter, a few elderly people were admitted with an encephalitis syndrome, which is fever, confusion, mental status changes, clearly different from a stroke, because there's no movement abnormality. But they were admitted in different hospitals. And so none of the two or three people were all taken care of by the same doctor or the same hospital. And so these were just thought to be individual random cases of encephalitis, and nobody put two and two together until finally, after literally pounding on the door of the CDC for 3 weeks, the news, Tracy McNamara managed to get the CDC to announce that there was a new virus, probably West Nile virus. And it's well known that that disease in the old world affects humans, particularly elderly people are susceptible, and that's when the link was made.
Hmm. Now, when Tracy McNamara first started to be concerned about the crows that were keeling over at the Bronx Zoo, mm-hmm. she wasn't sure if it was a virus or a bacterium. What's the difference between the two, and how are they identified?
First she became very sure literally within a day or two. And that's because she took a look under the electron microscope, where she saw particles that were so small, but inside the neurons of the brain of the animals, that they could only be viruses, because bacteria are both larger in size and very different in morphology or appearance. So it didn't take her very long to know that she was dealing with a virus. Viruses are, by definition, obligately intracellular organisms. They have to live, reproduce, and then promulgate from another cell, a mammalian cell, a reptile cell, sometimes even a bacterial cell can be invaded by viruses. So they're not free living. Bacteria, generally speaking, are much larger, generally free living. There's some rare exceptions to that. And easy to tell the difference just by looking under the microscope. So she knew within a day or so that she was dealing with a virus. And finally, Encephalitis in birds is almost always caused by viruses. There are many dozens of them that can do it. And I think the key finding that Tracy made was recognizing that she could narrow that long list down to just a few dozen actors, or maybe even less than a dozen actors, simply by observing what birds were affected and what were not. That's the magic of having smart people get their hands on the information and share that information in near real time.
West Nile is a zoonotic disease. What does that mean?
Zoonotic diseases are, by definition, diseases that do not require humans as a host for continuing their existence and spread. So humans are sometimes referred to as the dead-end hosts of the zoonoses. By the way, there's an opposite analogy from the animal's perspective called anthronotic diseases. Those are diseases in humans that occasionally get into animals, like tuberculosis, for example. So it works both ways. The point is, though, in zoonotic disease, that animals are the reservoir. Humans are an unnecessary but occasional innocent bystander in the spread of the disease. And they tend to be very severe in humans because the organism, because it doesn't depend on humans for its continued procreation, doesn't really have to worry about whether or not it kills the host before it spreads from one human to another. So as a general rule of thumb, there are exceptions, of course, like there are always in biology. Zoonotic diseases tend to be very severe in humans. And if you think about them, what are the zoonotic diseases that we worry about? Well, anthrax, plague, encephalitis, tularemia, and guess what? Those are, in fact, the organisms that were chosen by the Soviet Union and even at one time by the United States as the organisms they would use in their biological weapons program because they were extremely severe diseases in humans.
Yeah. How does a pathogen make the jump?
I don't think we have a good answer to that question. It's a fair question. I would be speculating if I really tried to answer it. I think it's simply fair to say that there's enough of a commonality in the cellular receptors and the basic metabolism of cells across all mammalian species that many organisms that affect animals can, in fact, survive in humans. And in some cases, organisms survive equally well in both. I'm thinking, for example, of salmonella in chickens or in humans. But how the leap is actually made is probably a series of random events in the gene structure of the organism, most of which fail to adapt the organism to a new species. But since these mutations occur so frequently, and in fact the viruses are designed to mutate, to not reproduce authentically each and every time their DNA with great precision, there's always a chance that that the viruses will adapt.
You say veterinarians, people like Tracy McNamara, are on the front line of our defense. Would you care to expand on that?
Well, sure. To pick up on the point I just made a moment ago, with the exception of smallpox, if we're talking about defense against bioterrorism, all of the organisms that have been in arsenals in the past for biological weapons are animal diseases. Anthrax, plague, tularemia being the leading one. Smallpox is the only exception. So if there were ever a large-scale dispersal, as opposed to the anthrax letter bombs, but let's say an aerosol spray from the back of a truck down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., it's a good bet that animals are going to get sick first, and it's also a good bet that vets will recognize it because these diseases are naturally occurring. They're rare, but they're naturally occurring in animals. And just about any vet worth his or her salt has seen a case or two of anthrax or plague in animals. We know in the one example where there was, in fact, a large-scale dispersal of a biological weapons agent, it was an error, it was a mistake, but it occurred in the town of Yekaterinburg in 1979 with anthrax from a military facility that was manufacturing it in the southeastern portion of the city, that sheep about 200 kilometers away actually came down with anthrax first. Now, of course, they didn't have an electronic disease reporting system at the time, but in retrospect, it's absolutely clear that it was, in fact, sheep who came down with symptoms. And it's so classical in sheep that veterinarians can make the diagnosis right away. Now, they didn't link it with a biological weapons facility, but if they had put points on the map where all the sheep were sick, they would have seen that they all sort of lined up right along with the wind pattern and would have been able to pinpoint the source had they had that information available. Mm-hmm. So that's why vets are, in my view, if there ever is a large-scale bioterrorism event, again, with the exception of smallpox, it's highly likely that a vet will make the diagnosis first, or perhaps a wildlife rehabilitation layperson who finds, for example, dead birds.
So the animals we live with, companion animals and livestock, we really need to pay attention to them, and also we need to take care in terms of how we interact with them, don't we?
Indeed we do. I can give you a concrete example of how animals have routinely served as unwitting canaries for disease here in New Mexico. New Mexico is one of the few places in the country that still, from time to time, has cases of human plague. It's carried by fleas, typically. The ground squirrel or prairie dog populations in New Mexico are often endemically infected with plague. And in each and every year when we've had a human case of plague, some years we don't have any, some years we have as many as six or seven, I don't think there's an exception to this. In every case, a domestic cat has shown up with plague first, usually 2 weeks before the human outbreaks occur, and that's because cats go out and wander around during the day and chase ground squirrels and prairie dogs out here in New Mexico, and they get a very classical syndrome. They don't die from plague, interestingly. They get very sick, but they get massively swollen lymph nodes and sometimes lesions in their mouths, and vets can make that diagnosis as soon as the animal comes into the clinic. I mean, they can smell it a mile away. Unfortunately, they write down the diagnosis on a piece of paper and stick it on a shelf, treat the animal gets better, and nobody knows about it. But it's a leading economic indicator for human plague in every year that we've had cases of human plague. That's a concrete example of how animals can serve as sentinel indicators, if you will.
Hmm. What do you think about exotic pets? Should we be cautioned against having them, or caution to just be extra cautious?
Well, that's a great question. It comes down to cases. Why anybody would really want to import a giant Gambian rat as a pet, which is how the monkeypox outbreak apparently started 2 years ago in the United States. Frankly, it's beyond me. I think dogs and cats are just fine, but they're, like it or not, there is a huge international trade in exotic animals. It's there's a wonderful book that's been written by it, and it's not well regulated from the standpoint of just a fundamental sensitivity to animal rights. It strikes me as a heinous kind of activity. And my personal belief, and it does come down, I'm afraid, to one's politics here, is that exotic animal trade just ought to be stopped. It's terrible for the animals. God knows what it does in terms of introducing disease into domestic animals, let alone into humans. And the animals are often terribly mistreated. So it bothers me a great deal, just really from the standpoint of disease, but it also bothers me from the standpoint of the way the animals are handled. I don't see any need for it, but I'm afraid it's just going to continue.
Mm. In some of the material that came along with the book, Microbe, mm-hmm. Are We Ready for the Next Plague?, there was an item about so-called pocket pets, hamsters and mice and that kind of thing, and apparently they can carry salmonella and a strain that's resistant to drugs.
Resistant to just about every drug, yeah, that's right. Many times... many times animals that are in pet shops, like hamsters, are fed in their diet antibiotics with the belief that it keeps the animal healthy until it can be sold. Well, that's just a perfect setup, isn't it, for creating antimicrobial resistance. So where antibiotics are used irresponsibly, and pet shop owners often do this, certainly farmers use antibiotics on a mega scale, there is a virtual certainty of developing a multiple antibiotic resistance. So, yeah, that hamster that you pick up at the local pet shop, if it's had tetracycline, ciprofloxacin, and ampicillin in its diet, and it probably has, you can bet it's carrying organisms that are resistant to those lead antibiotics that we have. And so it limits our choices tremendously if a human gets sick.
Mm. Speaking of humans, what can we do to minimize our risk of becoming ill as far as taking care of our homes and handling food? We've talked quite a bit here about companion animals and livestock. What about inside the house, what the things that we do to try and protect ourselves?
Well, I'm going to give you a an answer that's not the conventional wisdom.
Okay.
The conventional wisdom, of course, is to spray around antibacterial agents, use antibacterial soaps, sterilize your house, sterilize your clothing, sterilize your dishes, turn up the dishwasher temperature to 180 degrees. And I would argue that that's a bridge too far. There's good reason to believe that that if you have absolutely no exposure or very little exposure to to common organisms, let's say soil organisms that are in very tiny quantities in your kitchen, if you have absolutely no contact with those at all, then you have no resistance to them because you never develop any antibodies against them. There's very, very little evidence that aside from cleaning up gross spills of animal fluids, like, for example, blood or fluids from a fresh chicken that you might cut up on your cutting board, there's very little evidence to indicate that anything beyond just washing with the cutting board with plain soap and water makes any difference whatsoever. And with regard to the use of antibacterial soaps in the bathroom, for example, mm-hmm. there's now very good evidence that all we've succeeded in doing is creating skin organisms that are resistant to the antibacterial that's in most of the soaps that are on the marketplace today. Doesn't help. Now, I'm not suggesting that anybody goes out and jumps into a mud pit with pigs. I'm just saying that we tend to overdo it dramatically in this country, and it probably not only doesn't do us any good, it certainly costs us a lot of money. One final point, there does appear to be, the statistics on this are becoming more and more convincing, there does appear to be a higher incidence of what we sometimes think of as environmental illness or autoimmune illness associated with lack of exposure to low levels, not mud piles in your kitchen, but low levels of bacteria. So the incidence of asthma, for example, appears to be partially associated with the increase in sterility in our home environments. Bottom line is we're just overdoing it, and we have much more important things to worry about than whether or not there is one bacteria per square meter on the kitchen floor.
Mm. And we're probably not washing our hands as we should be, but we're worried about what's on the floor.
Exactly. right. Simple hand washing isn't even done in hospitals, as we know, and is probably the single most cost-effective thing we could do to stop the hundreds of thousands of cases of hospital-acquired infections, and very few people do it.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Dr. Alan Zelikoff, he's co-author of the book Microbe, Are We Ready for the Next Plague? He's a physician and a physicist. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions or comments. Look forward to hearing from you this afternoon. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, back to West Nile. What have public health authorities learned as a result of that first outbreak in 1999? And has those lessons been applied in other things that are coming down the pike?
The answer to your second question is no, unequivocally. The lessons have not been applied. I do think lessons have been learned and published, but they've not been applied. What are those lessons?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're twofold. One is that hours matter. Days are too late when there's a novel disease that particularly if it's vector-borne by mosquito or birds, as is the case with West Nile, because these creatures can move over large areas very quickly. And second is that all of the novel diseases that we've had to face in the past 3 or 4 decades, like hantavirus or monkeypox or West Nile, cryptosporidiosis in Milwaukee, not far from you, that sickened 400,000 people, all have one thing in common. They're eminently untreatable and eminently preventable. So if you can find them early, you can stop the outbreak, usually just by intervening with the vector or having people boil water or other simple trivial things like that. But we failed to take those lessons to heart. Even today, we have no real-time or anything close to real-time surveillance system that communicates unusual signs and symptoms of in animals or humans with people who need to have that information. And that would be, of course, public health officials, veterinarians, doctors, school nurses, and emergency medical service personnel, and on rare occasions, political decision makers. Now, there are a few exceptions to that. West Texas, oddly enough, has recognized the cost-effectiveness of having such a system, and they've had one for 4 years. It's the one that began at Sandia that I invented and has now been dramatically rewritten and commercialized into a truly functional system called the Syndrome Reporting Information System. We've had two remarkable successes in West Texas that I don't think public health can claim have ever occurred before. One was actually ruling out a bioterrorism event without spending millions of dollars. In fact, no money was spent, simply because there was good surveillance in real-time information being exchanged among all the communities that needed to know via the Internet, via this particular software. And the other was the early detection of influenza in Lubbock, Texas, a college town where influenza can spread like wildfire, 2 months before the typical CDC-based laboratory system picked it up. And that enabled an early vaccination campaign to take place, which literally stopped what would otherwise have been probably a really awful influenza year in 2003 in Lubbock. So the lesson's pretty clear. For not very much money, for a fraction of a tenth of a percent of the money we've wasted in our current counter-bioterrorism spending for moon suits and more laboratory equipment and other things that are practically useless in an outbreak, for a small fraction of a percent of what's already been spent, we could outfit the entire country with a real-time disease surveillance system that physicians can use, veterinarians, school nurses, laboratories, public health officials, and they can at least get the information to people who need to know it, who can analyze it, and turn that around, not in 10 weeks, which is the usual turnaround time for public health, but in something closer to 10 minutes, and I'm not making that number up. That avoids stupid decisions such as making travel and trade restrictions like we did in SARS, probably the single most stupid decision we could have made in SARS. It cost billions of dollars, did no good whatsoever. And also prevents doctors from passing out unnecessary drugs, doing unnecessary diagnostic tests, which can not only run up medical costs but can increase panic. So the key is simple exchange of information across the communities that have, unfortunately, bureaucratic barriers between them. And that's what we've overcome with Cirrus, and it works, and it's cheap, and public health systems at the local level around the country are starting to adopt it. And I don't think they would, since they're cash-strapped, unless they recognized its cost-effectiveness.
Mm. How widely has it been adopted?
We're now in 3 states. Soon to be in a fourth, Missouri, Texas, and Southern California. about 50 or 60 counties covering roughly, I would say now, about close to 3 million people. So in some critical areas, and particularly in West Texas and Southern California along the border where we worry about disease going in both directions, we're starting to get very robust coverage that's of extreme importance for both animal and human disease. But it's nowhere near enough. One would like to see this done across the whole country. Mm.
Can you give us a sense of how it works?
Sure. CIRIS, the Syndrome Reporting Information System, is based on, as its name suggests, a syndrome. And a syndrome is nothing more than a description. It's not a diagnosis. It's not a laboratory-confirmed culture, but rather a description of the symptoms. That's what you complain about when you go to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And the signs, that's what the doctor finds on exam or what the veterinarian finds on exam. Along with one other key important point, which is the judgment of the professional that the animal or human that they're dealing with is truly sick. And I use the word sick in a generic sense, but every good clinician knows what I mean when I say that. So, for example, lay people are fond of saying that they had the flu and they were out of work for a day. Well, let me tell you, that wasn't the flu. If you're out of work for a day, it was probably the common cold, because flu is a severe illness. It's not a runny nose, a sore throat, and a mild headache. It's high fever and prostration and muscle aches. And so what we ask the physicians and the vets to do is not to report every case of runny nose and sore throat that they see, but rather for that 0.5%, it's literally that few, 1 out of 200, maybe 1 out of 300 cases that they see, where they have a gut sense that the animal or human is clearly sick, someone you might think about admitting to the hospital, for example, with a fever and symptoms that are strongly suggestive of an infectious disease, even if you don't know what the diagnosis is, to report that case. So, for example, if you were to see birds with encephalitis or birds falling out of the sky or birds with a neurologic syndrome, that is one of the syndromes in CIRIS, and that was co-located with humans who were having an encephalitis syndrome. Again, not a diagnosis, but a description of somebody who is febrile and not thinking very clearly and maybe exhibiting bizarre behavior. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to link those two in space and time, and you know you almost certainly have a vector-borne disease. If nothing else, you can dramatically limit the so-called differential diagnosis, the likely possibilities, from a few hundred organisms down to a small handful, 1, 2, or 3. And at that point, the public health officials can ask the doctors to order up tests that they usually don't order up simply because they don't know about them, and make the diagnosis in hours, definitively in either the humans or the animals or both. That's the key to CIRIS. It does not sweep up huge amounts of data like data mining systems do and look for some statistical variation, which could take days to weeks to be realized, but rather depends on the judgment of trained professionals who may not know what they're looking at, but are certainly smart enough to know that they're looking at an animal or a human that's sick, and it works.
Hmm. Could this model be used for intelligence gathering in terms of other threats that we face?
So it's a very good question. I've not tested that hypothesis. My gut sense is that the answer is yes. And I base this on our experience in Texas, where we've actually now presented the work that the folks in West Texas have been doing for 4 years, the real on-the-ground public health use of CIRIS, to the state's Homeland Security Director. And he observed that the same approach, sharing of information on a map, we color code it so that it's visually very accessible and very easy to quickly tell what's going on. You don't have to look through reams of data. Could be used for police reports or intelligence hits or suspicious behavior that gets reported to a 911 call-in line for Homeland Security sorts of applications. it's an intriguing theory, and my guess is, I'm not certain of this, but my guess is that the state of Texas as a state now is in fact going to use Cirrus for the purpose that you suggest, even though it was designed as a disease monitoring system.
Hmm. Now, this disease monitoring system, back to disease, can it be used then to get a handle on who's at risk, how quickly the organism may reproduce, and how quickly infection could spread?
Yes. The answer to all those questions is yes. And we've designed the system to focus in on the key pieces of data that address exactly the questions that you just asked about. So we were after not every little detail, but the pieces of information that would tell me what's the likely population at risk here. So we ask about age, sex, and geographic location, which in turn gives you socioeconomic data from the Census Department. We ask about travel. And finally, we ask about which of six syndromes you put a human into. And it turns out that six syndromes cover 98%, 97% of all of the diseases of concern that are out there. So simply by asking age range, sex, travel history, and which syndrome you would put somebody into, you can define a population at risk. That, in turn, is used by the public health officials when they see that data come in to automatically set a certain alarm criteria within Cirrus, such that if other cases like those are reported, even if the public health official isn't sitting at their computers, and they're busy people, they're not sitting at their desks all day, Cirrus automatically sends them an alarm with the doctor's name or the veterinarian's name and phone number, and they can pick up the phone and be on the in a conversation with that doctor or vet in literally minutes and starting a contact investigation instantaneously. So that is precisely what Cirrus does. It does address who's at risk, where the likely organism came from, particularly if travel is involved, and whether or not it's both a human and animal disease, that is a zoonotic disease.
Mm. Dr. Ellen Zelikoff is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions for our guest this afternoon. He is co-author of the book Microbe, Are We Ready for the Next Plague? The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. That word plague is a pretty frightening word. So, too, are the words outbreak, epidemic, pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
How are these terms defined? What are the hallmarks?
It's whatever the local public health official decides it to be.
Wow.
There is a definition for an epidemic, but it is so soft that it comes down to whatever the local public health official says it is. So, for example, two children with a skin rash that is characterized by little points of bleeding in their skin, who have a stiff neck, that's an epidemic until proven otherwise of a disease called meningococcal meningitis, which can move through a daycare center or a college dormitory in a few hours and can kill very, very rapidly. So as my colleague Gary Simpson at the New Mexico Department of Health, who's largely the intellectual inspiration behind Cirrus, puts it, he says, an epidemic is what I say it is, and it comes down to cases. So getting the key piece of information to the local public health official might mean that a case of one, an N of one, is an outbreak that could then lead to an epidemic, which you might define as 1% or 2% of the population involved. But that N of 1, if it's a communicable disease like meningococcus or measles or, heaven forbid, smallpox, if someone were to ever introduce it again, that N of 1 can become an N of hundreds of thousands within days. And if you don't start intervening within hours, you can take your national pharmaceutical stockpile and just go home. It doesn't make any difference. So, an outbreak can be literally a case of one. In the animal world, one case of foot and mouth disease is a national nightmare for the United States. Billions of dollars in lost agricultural economic productivity. thousands, if not tens of thousands of animals suffering the same fate as what happened in England a couple of years ago, where they had to be destroyed, and that's very difficult to watch as well as being very expensive.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener, a caller in Urbana, on line one. Hi.
Yeah, I had two questions. I was wondering, could your guest explain why it is that you always hear more about pigs being a source of illness rather than, say, for example, other primates like monkeys and stuff, which you would think would make an easy bridge? And then two, I don't know if you've heard this, but Craig Venter, mm-hmm. The guy that worked
right.
on the human genome.
You bet.
He said one of his current projects is to create synthetic life by engineering a microbe from DNA up.
Right.
And I was curious if you had any thoughts about that, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, let me address the first question first, because I know time is short, and it's probably the more important. I'll try to get to the second one. The reason that pigs are more widely appreciated as sources of infection than, say, primates is really twofold. One is there are far more pigs in contact with people than there are primates. If you think about Southeast Asia, or if you think about Southeast Arkansas, there are just these enormous pig farms where pigs are raised for food, and they're literally pigs sold in live animal markets in Southeast Asia in particular. So there are billions of interactions between humans and pigs all the time. So that's one reason. And the second reason is that it just so happens, and we don't understand exactly why this is, but it just so happens that pigs appear to be the mixing vessel where multiple strains of influenza can be accommodated at one time. And because the influenza virus can then infect two different strains of influenza virus can infect the pig at the same time, what pops out as a new virus from the pig cells may be a mix of the some combination of the genomic material of the other influenzas that were in the pig, creating, presto, a brand new influenza. This is the so-called mixing vessel hypothesis of influenza. Birds are the natural reservoir of influenza. They tend to light in areas where there's a lot of water in Southeast Asia. That tends to be where pigs are, and therefore pigs get multiply infected. And then every once in a while, a new strain of pig virus pops out that, oh, by the way, binds to a human receptor as well. So that's why pigs are well known. With regard to Dr. Ventner's work, it's not completely novel. If you go back and look at the newspaper about a year ago, you'll find that people created a polio virus literally in the laboratory from the ground up. This is a simple trick now in modern microbiology. Now, what Ventner's talking about is something just a little bit different, not recreating a life form that we already know exists, but a totally new kind of life form. But in principle, it's no different than what was done with the polio virus about a year ago. And it does raise troubling questions about our ability to perhaps alter organisms in a way, not necessarily to make them any worse than the horrible organisms that are already out there, like smallpox and anthrax and plague, but maybe extend their host range, or maybe make them antibiotic resistant, or maybe enable them to cause even different syndromes than they normally do, so that it makes their recognition more difficult. All the more reason for having a real-time disease surveillance system for capturing those novel disease outbreaks.
Mm. We have to wrap up here. Just a quick thought or two about mad cow.
Yes. Well, in the United States, a terribly overblown problem. Two cases that we have seen, there may be a third, almost certainly occurred as a result of the cows receiving the feed that was banned in the United States in the late 1990s and banned in England many years before that, which include ground-up cow parts, which included the prions that caused mad cow disease. I don't think it's a big problem. It gets people's attention because of its name, because of its notoriety, but we have far more important infectious diseases to worry about, in my view, than mad cow.
And those would include smallpox?
Smallpox, novel strains of influenza, and vector-borne diseases like hepatitis that will probably be the plagues of the future. Now, clearly, when you alter the natural environment of a cow by feeding other cow parts to it, you're just asking for trouble. But we've stopped doing that, thank goodness, and hopefully we won't repeat that mistake. I do think that we have vector-borne disease primarily to worry about, and then next on the list would be bioterrorism.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time, sorry to say. Dr. Zelikoff, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Alan Zelikoff has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. He's co-author of the book Microbe, Are We Ready for the Next Plague? The book is published by Amacom. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
This is Todd Gleason. Let's take a look at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade, the Mercantile Exchange for the afternoon. Futures like this at the board. The wheat futures taking the biggest loss for the day. They were down a nickel. The soybeans managed a bit of a rally. They were up 4 to 5 cents today, and the corn was, well, unchanged to down a penny on the day. September wheat now, 3.10 and a quarter was the final trade, down 5 and a half cents today, a 3.21 and a half high, low at 3.10. And once again, that September wheat settled at $3.10 and a quarter since the soft red winter wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, down 5 and a half cents. December contract for the day, 3.36 and a half, the high, the low at 3.24 and a half. Settlement price there, $3.25. They were down 6 and a quarter. In the March futures, 3.48 and a half high, low at 3.37 and a quarter. Settlement price at 337 and three quarters, down 6 cents for the day. May contract in the wheat pit, 354 the high, the low at $3.44. Settled on that low, down 5 and a half cents. In July contract, this is the harvest month for next year, 2006, $3.56 the high, the low at 345, and a settlement price at $3.47 a bushel for July wheat, down 5 cents for 2006. September corn futures, nearby contract, 212 and three quarters the high, the low at 209 and a quarter. Settled just above that low at 209 and a half. They were off a penny for the day. The December contract at 225 and three quarters high, low at 222. Settled $2.22 and a quarter. They were down one. And the March futures at 235 and a quarter high, low at 231 and three quarters. Settlement there at $2.32, down a penny for the day. May futures in the corn pit, 241 and a half the high, low at 238 and a quarter. Settlement price at 238 and a quarter for the May corn. Down a penny for the day, and July futures off 1 cent as well. 242 and a half, the settlement price there. The high at 45 and three quarters, the low at $2.42 and a quarter for July corn next year. September futures next year, 248 and a half, the high, the low at 45 and a half. Settled on that low, and they were down a penny and three quarters for the September 2006 corn contract. September oats now 152 and a half, the high, the low at 150 and a half. And a settlement price at 115 and a half. They were down a penny and a half for the day. December contract at 161 and a half high, low at 159 and a half. Settled at 159 and three quarters, down three quarters of a cent. September soybeans 6.19 and three quarters the high, low at $6.13. Settled 6.16. They were up four for the day. November beans were 5 and a quarter cents high. They settled at $6.25, 6.28 the high, the low at 6.20. And once again, the November beans settled at $6.25 a bushel. They were up 5 and a quarter cents on the day. January futures up 6 and a quarter, the high at 6.33 and a half, the low at 25 and a half, and the Jans settled $6.30 and a half, up 6 and a quarter. March futures 6.36 and a half, the high, the low at 6.28. Settlement price at 6.32 and a half. They were up 5 and a quarter. In the May futures, 6.37 and a half. The high, low at $6.29. Settled 6.35 and a half, and they were a nickel higher. July contract 6.40 and a half. The high, the low at 6.33. Settled 6.38 and a quarter, and they finished up 8 cents. Bean meal futures September contract 194.70. The high, the low at 191.40. Settlement price at 192.70, up 1 cent. And the October futures were up $1.30 for the day. They had a high price at 195.20 and a low at 191.80. And the October bean meal settled at 192.80, up 1.30. September bean oil 22.45, the high, the low at 22.27. Settlement price there 22.29. They were a penny higher for the day, and the October were unchanged at 22.52 for the bean oil. On the high side, the low at 22.36. Settlement price for the soybean oil October contract 22.39. It finished unchanged. During the closing market report this afternoon, we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodity Markets in New Market, Indiana, and we'll take a look at what happened with yesterday's crop progress report with the state statistician politicians from Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Nebraska, and Minnesota, along with telling you a little bit more about Agronomy Day, which is coming up this Thursday right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. That all kicks off at 7 o'clock this Thursday morning. I'll be there, and I hope to see you there as well. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Livestock prices finished higher today, Todd. August feeder cattle, 110.05 the high, 109.60 the low, 109.92 and a half the settlement, that up 25. September, 108 even the high, 107.15 the low, the settlement, 107.40, that up 30. October, 106.75 the high, the low, 105.95, the settlement, 106.30, that up 40. August live cattle, 79.50 the high, 78.55 the low, the settlement, 78.77 and a half, that down 2.5. October live cattle, 80.47 and a half the high, 79.60 the low, the settlement, 79.90, that up 2.5. October lean hog, 60.90 the high, 59.90 the low, 60.75 the settlement, that up 55. December, 58.95 the high, 58 even the low, 58.87 and a half the settlement, that up 27 and a half. February, 60.30 the high, 59.70 the low, the settlement, 60.25, that up 15. And April lean hog, 60.60 the high, 59.97 and a half the low, the settlement, 60.60, that up 42 and a half. August pork bellies, 72.52 and a half the high, 70 even the low, the settlement, 71.25, that up 72 and a half. The Dow is off 83 points at 10,551, the NASDAQ down 22 at 2145, and the S&P 500 10 lower at 1224.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers. The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carl Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Barry Eckert from Birmingham, Alabama writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why is it that cybersex feels just like typing?"
Even in today's virtual reality, some things are realer than others. For example, when you're pretending to fly a Boeing 747 on a flight simulator, you're really just sitting at home holding a joystick. And when you're having cybersex, well, you're really just sitting at home pecking at a keyboard and holding, well, something else. In either case, someone is helping you follow your imagination along familiar lines. Now remember, no matter how old you are, it's not too late to get a life.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions.